Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this week we are going to be analysing the Universal Credit System, the new governmental system which is meant to replace all benefits with one simple, easy payment, and which has been dogged by delays, inefficiency and disasters for the people actually meant to be receiving the benefits in the first place. We will also have a special Private Eye Christmas treat. This is an exclusive extract of the show that the Eye did at the National Theatre, Private Eye at the National, featuring bits of the Private Eye annual dramatised by a cast of crack comedic talent. But first, universal credit. This is the system introduced by the coalition government, designed to replace the UK's previous system of complicated and extremely difficult to navigate benefits with one simple, easy payment. Sounds like a very good idea in theory, but in practice, it is now 5 years overdue, it's extremely complicated, and there have been plenty of delays in people receiving the money to which they are entitled. Private Eye has been writing about this for some time now, and Heather Mills has been our correspondent dealing with the details of universal credit and exactly where it's going wrong. Let's start off by asking Heather which six benefits universal credit has been designed to replace.
So it was income support, income-based job seekers allowance, income-related employment and support allowance for those with disabilities, housing benefit, child tax credit and working tax credit.
So all of those things, instead of getting six different payments, or however many you're eligible for, you get one payment each month.
That's right. That was the aim, to make it far more simple. And it was one payment per family as well.
So this sounds like quite a sensible idea.
Yep, it was a sensible idea. It had cross-party support. It was also designed so that there was an incentive for you always to be better off if you had low-paid work. You may remember under the old system, there was lots of talk of people being caught in a benefits trap, i.e. if they found a few hours work, they would then be disqualified for all sorts of benefits. And so they were far worse off actually finding those few hours of work. So there was no limit on the number of hours you could work, but the amount of reward you got for each pound you earned was reduced. But it meant you would be better off if you had some hours of work. It was also, you know, with the name universal, it combined those in low paid, it combined those with some with disabilities and those who weren't working at all. So there was no stigma for anybody. You know, it was a whole kind of universal thing. It was all supposed to be, you know, much more creditable. And, you know, one of the very early aims was to reduce the number of children living in relative poverty. And of course, we now learned in recent weeks that actually the numbers they were hoping to lift out of poverty, about 350,000. In fact, the whole benefit system and the cuts have put an extra 350,000 to 400 children in poverty.
All of the above, the simplification, the removal of stigma, the being better off in work, no matter what, these all sound like very sensible aims.
They were. And what all went wrong was in the implementation. They hadn't thought it through properly. The targets for introducing it were too quick. And they had also, as part of the government's cuts that have come in, there were reductions in the amount of benefit that people could get. So, for example, under universal credit, you can only claim for two children. So you might have four children in your family. The whole delay system, the thing that's been attacked so much in the media recently and that the Chancellor has sought to address, that was to save the government money as well. The first week of payment, people weren't going to be paid for and, in fact, haven't been paid for. And then, of course, we've had inflation going up, benefits being cut, and people are worse off than anticipated.
So the delay in rolling out the whole scheme was obviously very bad and is ongoing, but that wasn't the only problem, or that was due to various other problems as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was wrong from the start. There were computer problems. There were management problems. It was criticised by the National Audit Office for being chaotic. It's 5 years behind schedule, so it was supposed to have been rolled out by 2017. As you know, it's still being rolled out across the country, and the expected date is now 2022, but of course it keeps going back. And until they get it right, you know, there's an argument that they shouldn't be rolling it out. There were other problems with it that weren't foreseen. In some months, the equivalent of 5 weeks' pay falls into 1 month, and that puts people over the limit, and they suddenly found they didn't have any money. There's also the introduction of sanctions for people who weren't deemed to be applying properly for jobs and all that kind of thing. And, you know, sometimes because these benefits were rolled into one for a family, you know, it might be one partner who had failed to turn up for an appointment. But of course, the whole family gets penalised if there's a sanction on the payment. I think they also didn't realise as they were rolling out how complicated the whole system is once you're no longer dealing with single people and universal credit. Once you start introducing families and families with children with disabilities, for example, then the whole question of working out families' pays and rates is terribly complicated. So that's why it had all these problems.
And as you say, there are cuts that are built into the transfer of benefits from one system to another.
Overall, there are less generous payments going into this.
What's the rationale behind that? I mean, obviously money saving, but is there anything more to it than that?
It's hard to find an argument that would suggest it was anything other than the government wanting to save money on its welfare bill.
Can I ask about the old system? Was that convoluted? Because it does sound, having six separate payments, that does sound complicated.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in principle, this should make it more simple. I suppose what I'm saying is that the calculations employed to bring all these things together make it as complex as it was. One of the other major disadvantages with universal credit is that housing benefit has been rolled into this. Now, housing benefit used to be paid directly to a landlord or a housing association. But by lumping it in with the payments to the families, who are, you know, generally very hard pushed, they then struggle. Sometimes, you know, when they're balancing debt, if you suddenly come across a big bill that you can't pay, then you don't pay your housing benefit on time. And if you, you know, once you start rolling into that whole debt situation, then what we're having with universal credit, of course, is, you know, people getting into arrears, rent arrears, facing eviction, borrowing and getting into debt.
So it effectively makes it harder for people on very low incomes to manage their
and
money.
And also that these are people also who have been used to budgeting weekly and who suddenly, with this huge gap, are forced to budget in a very different fashion. And again, that's very difficult when you're on a low income, you know, and you suddenly get a big utility bill in, and that's another one that has to be paid for fear of being cut off.
So in response to all of this, there was an announcement in the budget that these changes are going to be addressed, either partially or wholly. Can you just tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. The Chancellor's gone some way to addressing some of the problems, and arguably the ones that had the greatest impact at the beginning. So he has now made it so that people no longer have to wait 6 weeks for their benefit. They only have to wait 5 weeks.
So there's been a cut in the delay that people have to.
But what he's also done, and what will help families enormously, is that he has made it clear that if people are in difficulties, they can apply for an advance payment straight away and they can get the whole of their month's payment straight away and they can pay that back over a prolonged period of time. Under the old system, people weren't told that they could qualify for an advance payment, which they could do actually. If they went to an advisor, they would then be told that they could. But it was only for half a month's pay, and they'd have to pay it back when they got their first payment. So that put them in difficulties as well. One of the other things, which he isn't dealing by this, of course, is that a lot of people have had to wait a lot longer than 6 weeks for their first payment. And that's if they had any difficulty in, for example, getting their tenancy agreement to prove that this was their rent, their housing benefit, and what they qualified for. Or if, for example, they weren't married to another English national, you know, and so a quarter of people were actually waiting far more than 6 weeks for their payment.
That's an enormous number.
It's a huge number. And I don't see that what the Chancellor is doing is going to help those people. The council tax thing will, but for immigration and all the other problems people have, you know, some of those still exist. Those problems still exist.
So that's the working benefits side of the equation. So now let's turn to the other side of the equation, which is things like disability benefits.
Yes. And of course, the government reforms to disability benefits have been arguably problematic. And the hardship caused has been even greater, one would argue. In fact, earlier this year, the United Nations report, the Committee on Rights for Disabled People, found that austerity in this country and the cuts to welfare benefits were catastrophic in terms of their effect on disabled people in our country, which seems pretty shocking, really. We used to be a leader in all of these things, and now the UN committee worries about us more than large parts of Europe.
So the changes that have been made...
In the same way with universal credit, there's been a move from the old benefit system onto new ones.
Right.
So disabled people now would have to apply for something called employment support allowance. And again, there's a good motive there. It's to try and encourage those and to help those and to give them more assistance, those who are able to work, to get into employment. You know, realistically, that's very difficult for people. And then they're changing. The other big change is moving people who were on, and these are people who generally are more severely disabled or have severe illnesses, who used to qualify, and some still do as the change is taking place, for something called disability living allowance. Now, that's the extra cost that you would need to maintain your independence in your house to cope with your disability or your illness. Now, they're now having to move to something called personal independence payments, or PIP. And that has been hugely problematic for people. At the heart of both of these changes are the fact that disabled people now go through health assessment tests. So if you were seeking Employment Support Allowance, ESA, you would go for a work capability test. These have all been privatised out, and they're carried out by health professionals employed by ATOS, Capita and Maximus. This is across both benefits. Mm-hmm. And these are largely tick box exercises. So your assessment is very narrow. It's on what people see at the assessment. And, you know, if they perceive that you're able to walk a few meters or something like that, you may not score the points you need to qualify for the benefits. These private companies make the reports, send them to the DWP, and they make the decision over what benefit, if any, you qualify for.
And it's very subjective. And not only is it subjective, as you've written in the eye, often the assessment that is delivered at the end of that test does not match with what actually happened.
No. In fact, people are now getting wise to what's going on. Some people are taking covert videos. Some people are taking a witness along just to prove that their assessment was different to what eventually appears in the report about them. With the changes to these benefits, the government has made, again, cuts. You know, it wanted to cut its welfare benefits. The UN report and all the organisations that represent disabled people suggest that the impact across the board of all the benefits on disabled people, that they've borne the brunt of it. So the impact is far higher on them than anyone else in the situation. Things like the bedroom tax, that impacted very highly on disabled people whose houses have often been converted to suit their needs, who sometimes need a carer to sleep in at night. But that was a huge impact on a low income, you know, to have that money taken away. For those who are considered able to do limited work, there's been a £30 a week cut in the amount of support they get, as to those people who are considered not able to work, who will get more.
Just to give a couple of concrete examples of things that you've written about in the magazine, the man who turned up to his disability assessment in a wheelchair, only to later read that, heaven be praised, he could walk, it turned out, according to the document that was then sent off to the DWP.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, he was very lucky and he had a witness. So chances are his assessment will be overturned either through mandatory reconsideration or on appeal.
Yes. Now, can we talk about that briefly?
Yes.
So if you challenge the assessment,
yes,
what happens next?
If you believe your assessment was unfair or inaccurate, or as we seem to be discovering, in fact, the Disability News Service have been collecting a huge number of these cases where it's suggested that there is, you know, deliberate untruths in these reports. If you think that's happened, or if you just think you haven't scored enough points for your disability, you have to apply for what is called a mandatory reconsideration. And that is basically a review by somebody in the Department of Work and Pensions who reviews what's in front of them. You may have been able, if you were lucky, to get a bit more extra medical evidence to back it up or whatever, but you go to a mandatory review. Unfortunately, it would appear that most of these decisions are upheld. So we then have huge numbers that then have to go to tribunal. But while this has happened, you may have lost your mobility car, or you won't be getting your extra money. And we've had shocking cases where, you know, people who are severely disabled have lost their higher level of payment, which means they no longer have their car because it's decided that they could walk for 50 metres or something. But actually, the fact is they couldn't walk to the bus stop, and they couldn't walk that without stopping several times or, you know, getting their breath back. And they lose their jobs. You know, they suddenly can't get to work. I mean, it's so short-sighted to cut these kind of benefits. And if you finally win your case at appeal, which can take several months, you know, your car's already gone. The devastation and the impact on your life has already happened.
And there are some cases, which I believe you've also written about, where a case has been about to go to a tribunal, so someone has challenged their assessment, that's been upheld, they've said, I'm still not happy about this, and I want to go to a tribunal, only for the DWP to roll over as soon as it's clear that it's going to go to a tribunal and say, all right then, we give up. Which that suggests that they're kind of trying it on in the first place, to use a technical legal term.
Yes, and there have been one or two of those. And unfortunately, there are more where they go to tribunal, and there have been some where by the time they get to tribunal, the claimant has died. And we've had some fairly shocking cases of people who had terminal illness, were supposed to bypass this PIP system. They were not supposed to face medical assessments. But the decision about who's ill enough or who's not ill enough goes to the companies who are carrying out the assessments, and they've been carrying out assessments on people who are terminally ill. And it seems that, you know, unless a doctor is prepared to say you're going to be dead within 6 months, for sure, whereas, as we know, doctors deal with averages and everything else, then some seriously ill people have had their application for PIP rejected. By the time it comes to tribunal, they are so ill they can't attend, or they've already died, and then the money will, presumably the back pay, will then go to their estate. I'm not quite sure how that would happen. And one very shocking case we were told about by an advisor who has done 30 terminally ill cases this year alone, of a young woman who had leukemia, who actually turned up to her tribunal with paramedics and an ambulance to get her benefits. I mean, the tribunal halted immediately, went out to her, and immediately granted her the higher rate of personal independence payments.
But the fact you have to get an ambulance to take you to your own tribunal.
Yes. And for those months when you needed the money, it's not been there.
So here's an irritatingly simple question. What needs to change?
If we're talking about these work capability tests and the assessments for personal independence payments, then they need to be far more flexible. They mustn't be these tick box systems. They need to rely more, the assessors need to rely more on the medical reports and the specialist reports that the claimant provides. Arguably, maybe, these assessments need to be recorded in some way. So that checks and balances are built into them. Mental health is a real problem for assessment as well. The trouble with the assessors is, you know, they're not necessarily specialists in the field by which they're judging people's abilities.
Yes, I wanted to ask, who are these assessors?
Well, they can be anything from, I mean, you might get doctors, but they could be nurses, they could be occupational therapists. You know, it covers a wide range of health workers. So, yeah, not necessarily suited to your disability.
So we return to the question of what needs to change. We've got the removal of the tick box exercises.
Yeah.
Perhaps some kind of recording of these assessments.
Yeah. Better checks and balances built into the system. The mandatory review clearly isn't good enough because it's not picking up enough of these cases that go to tribunal. About 65% of cases that go to tribunal are overturned at tribunal. So that's a high number. That's 6 out of every 10 that go to tribunal are successful. The DWP, of course, will argue that it's carried out, or there have been about 2.6 million of these assessments over the years, and that only 8% of those go to tribunal. But that's still...
That's quite a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. You know, yeah. You can talk about, you know, that might sound quite good as a sort of, but the impact on, what, 200 odd thousand people's lives is devastating.
Heather Mills there. And there will be more updates on the Universal Credit fiasco as and when they happen in the pages of the magazine. Now, we wouldn't want to end the year without some kind of Christmas treat, so we're going to end the show today with an extract from Private Eye's performance at the National Theatre, in which a cast of brilliant comedians dramatise sections of the Private Eye Annual, looking back at the highlights and the lowlights of the year that we've just had. So here, in no particular order, are Ian Hislop, John Sessions, Lewis MacLeod, Jan Ravens, and Craig Brown.
Boris Johnson is our Foreign Secretary, and earlier this year, in part of his job, he was sent out to deal with Hurricane Irma in the Caribbean. Fortunately for Private Eye, he sent us his diary, thinking we were the Telegraph.
Cripes! Guess where old Bozza has been? Only the British Virgin Islands, and no jokes about virgins, thank you very much. Bojo's a serious international statesman now, and not just a world-famous ladies' man who turned up hoping to meet this Irma everyone's talking about. Anyway, no more talk of dusky maidens or trousers at half-mast. This is proper Larif, Bozzle style, stop it matron. First up, Mrs. May called me in and said, it's terribly dangerous over there and somebody might get lost in a whirlwind and never come back. I know just the chap to send on the first plane over. You! So I put on a natty crumpled linen suit looking suitably Raj, though the FO Spoil Sports told me to leave the pith helmet at home. And shazam, I was off on a mission to reassure Johnny Native that he was just as British as the rest of us, and that Her Madge was doing everything she could to rebuild his hut. Just as soon as we could get the Navy to send over HMS Inadequate with enough mud and straw. And it all went very well. I was greeted at what remained of the airport, armed with a jar of Marmite and a mug saying, keep calm and carry on, by hundreds of grateful coconut munchers, singing, dancing, and holding up banners reading, haven't we suffered enough? Good to see they've kept their sense of humour. They appreciate I'm flying the flag for Blighty, which is pretty easy when the wind blows this strongly. Anyway, I've promised the downtrodden denizens of the Caicos and Etos Islands a whole load of dosh courtesy of the British taxpayer so they can rebuild all their fine offices with shiny new brass plates on the doors so that those clever chaps can show everyone how to avoid paying any tax. Bozzle's put his size 10s in it. Still, think he got away with it. Nobody noticed now. Where are all those British virgins I keep hearing about?
In the interests of balance, I feel I should now present an extract from our long-running interview feature. This is where we take people in the public eye and ask them serious questions about their spoons. This is the Me and My Spoon column. And in 2017, our biggest interview was with Diane Abbott. How many spoons would you say were appropriate for the ordinary hardworking family?
Well, we estimate we... Well, we estimate a figure of 74,603 as the ideal norm. As a rough estimate, that is, we...
Really? As many as that? How do you arrive at that figure?
Well, we get the figure. We get the figure because that is what the figure is.
What would be the cost of almost 75,000 spoons per average household?
Well, the average price of, say, £3.76 per spoon, the total cost would come to about £18.62,
Forgive me, but I don't follow your arithmetic. If you estimate the price of a spoon at £3.76...
Jeremy has made it very clear that a Labour government will ensure sufficient high-quality spoons for the many and not just the few.
Could I take you back to the financial aspect for a moment? The figure of £18.62.
It is only fair that those who can afford it will have to pay a little bit extra for their spoons. It is scandalous that in the 21st century there are literally millions unable to afford whatever it is we're talking about.
Diane Abbott! The President had a number of moments this year, one of which was after some riots in Charlottesville. And commenting on the riots, President Trump seemed to have problems with moral equivalence of the two sides. Private Eye printed, Trump's view of the great conflicts of history. The Second World War.
Good and bad on both sides. Sure, there were lots of Nazis, but then some very violent people tried to stop them holding a legitimate march through Eastern Europe. You want to pull down all the statues of Hitler next? Outlaw salutes, get real.
The Lord of the Rings.
Good and bad on both sides. Was that evil eye really all evil? No, it was not. Should you trust men with very hairy feet who steal other people's rings? And just because a guy dresses up with a pointy hat and says he's a wizard doesn't mean he's a fascist. And even if he is, so what? It's a free Middle Earth. I've met some of those orcs, and they're fine human beings, even if they're not human beings.
Star Wars.
Good and bad on both sides. Those stormtroopers certainly know how to maintain law and order. Sometimes the guys dressed all in white are the good guys. It's something I've spotted because I watch it more carefully than you. And just because he covers his face and blows up entire planets does not make Darth Vader a bad guy. I've met some of those Ewoks. Everybody says they're so cute, but I'm not. I hate them. And even this, they didn't have a permit. I know things that you do not know.
Tom and Jerry.
Good and bad on both sides. I mean, did you see the mouse use that frying pan right in his face? Okay, so Tom was trying to eat him, but he's a cat. Jerry's a mouse. That's how it is. Think about it.
God and Satan.
Good and bad on both sides.
Ladies and gentlemen, Trump.
Thank you very much.
That's the US leader. What about our own glorious leader? At least she's more amenable to the media and appears on tough interview shows like The One Show. We were very lucky to be given a complete transcript of her appearance with her husband, Phil, on The One Show.
Wow! Guess who we're interviewing?
Only the Prime Minister, woo! And Mr. Prime Minister, double woo!
So... Philip, what's it like being married to the most powerful woman in the country?
It's great. We're very much a team, and we support each other, with Philip supporting me and me telling him what to do. Isn't that right, Philip?
I take the bins out.
Not yet, Philip. That's the next question.
So, who does the household duties?
It was love at first sight.
No... No, Philip.
I thought we'd agreed I'd say that.
There are boy jobs and girl jobs, and Philip takes the bins out.
Oh, yes. I remember. I take the bins out.
Just like normal people. This is amazing.
So, Mrs. May, we were all wondering, what did your father do?
Well, interestingly, and I don't think a lot of people know this, my father was a vicar, making me a vicar's daughter. Isn't that right, Philip?
I take the bins out.
We've done that bit, Philip.
It was love at first sight.
Not yet. Not yet.
Strong and stable.
This is amazing. Wow. What did you say your father did again?
He was a strong and stable vicar.
Mrs. May, can I ask a tough personal question?
Uh-oh. I think I know what's coming.
Well, of course you do. We cleared it with your office. Now, I know it's difficult to talk about, and you rarely open up about it, but do you like shoes?
Yes.
Oh, you heard it here first. The one show has a scoop. Mrs. May is actually a vicar's daughter who likes shoes.
I take the bins out.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Prime Minister.
That's it for this show and also for this year. Thank you very much indeed for listening. We hope that you've enjoyed it. And if you find it in your heart to give someone, or for that matter yourself, a subscription to Private Eye for Christmas, we would be very glad of that indeed. We'll be back again in the new year with more episodes of Page 94. Until then, that's all from me and from our producer, Matt Hill. See you next time. Goodbye.